Thank you.
Do I need to back up, John, or keep going?
No. Keep England going.
Okay. So we've got two growth managers, that's Walter Scott and Invesco, and we've got two value managers being Boston Partners and Manulife, and then, of course, our dedicated EM manager, which is RBC. What you're seeing here is the weights as of June 30th within the total public equity composition. If you want to look at relative to the larger portfolio at our targets, the targets would be 40% of the portfolio to the four global equity managers, 10% to emerging markets, for a total of 50%. So right now we're sitting about 27% across the four and 2.5% in emerging markets. But we're just under 30%, so we are under-allocated to the asset class. And then the last thing I'll mention on this slide is we look at the structure with regards to public equity, which is all of the managers, including emerging markets, and then what we call global equity, which is just the four global equity managers without emerging markets. And we look at it that way because emerging markets really is a separate market and it's really a separate sub-asset class. And we want to see having that dedicated EM contributes to or detracts from performance overall. John, if you go to the next slide on 37. Just a quick review of the performance. Again, at the top you see public equity, which includes the emerging markets. The bottom chart is global equity, which excludes the dedicated emerging markets. If you look at the excess return line on the bottom, you don't see a great deal of difference between the two at this point, and that's because the emerging markets really hasn't had a significant impact one way or the other at this point. The other thing to notice is we're looking at the longer term. We are seeing the excess return and the outperformance. In the shorter term, we are underperforming a bit, and this actually is something that we expect and have seen play out historically. Our portfolio is kind of designed to protect a little bit more and outperform in the down markets, but that typically means that it's going to lag then in the quickly rising or rallying markets, and that's why we're seeing some underperformance on the year-to-date. But again, overall, still generating excess returns. The other key thing to look at here,
Greg, when you put the structure together, what was your goal on the alpha? I mean, it seems like 50 to 80, 90 basis points what you're getting for 3 to 10 years, which is pretty good. But what were you expecting to get?
So we're expecting to get around 100 to 150 basis points.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. It's a good question. Thank you. And the other thing to look at here is if you look at the three-year column, because this structure was actually implemented in July of 2017. So, you know, we really look at that three-year mark as being significant based on the current structure. So all of this you're seeing probably in notices as of June 30th, and we've seen a lot of market activity since then. To give you a more recent update, you know, the markets peaked around September 2nd, declined fairly quickly, and had a little bit of a bounce back. So right now we're on target for a quarter to date and year to date of an underperformance of about 100 basis points. So, John, if we go to the next slide, please.
Greg, you're saying 100 basis points in those, what, week? Like in a week?
No, for the quarter to date.
Oh, okay.
And the year to date overall.
Okay.
Yeah, so, within the week, what we kind of saw was what we would expect is we did a little bit better when the markets were declining, and then lagged whenever they started to bounce back a bit. So on slide 38, when we're talking about diversification and why we built the structure, we looked closely at how the managers interact with each other because we want to have managers that are performing differently in different market environments. And one way to look at that is through the excess return correlations. As you probably know, the lower the correlation, the better. And when you look across the board, you see we've got a pretty good interaction across the managers. In fact, the average excess correlation of just the four global equity managers is really about 0.11. A high correlation, obviously, of one even would mean that they're moving in lockstep with each other. So moving to slide 39, we wanted to look at the risk statistics, and again, we're measuring these over about 3 years. So beta is a good measure of kind of market sensitivity. When we look at the managers, you see some of the managers are pretty high beta managers, and then some of the managers are relatively low beta managers. And so overall, we've got a portfolio that is just under one. Tracking error is really looks at we look at this because it's a kind of a way of measuring the active management of the portfolio, and it looks at performance differences of the benchmark over time. So within an active manager program versus a passive program, you want to see a fairly reasonable amount of tracking error, and you do see that across the different managers. Now, when it all rolls up into the public equity and the global equity, the tracking error is a bit lower, and that, again, is kind of due to the diversification of the managers. The next column we look at – go ahead.
I was going to say, okay, go ahead. I'll wait till you get to the end of the chart.
Okay. So the active share we look at is, again, active share is how the holdings of the portfolio differ from the index. That can be either by holding out of index names or different weightings of holdings within the index. In an active managed program, you typically want to see a pretty high active share. And when you look across the individual managers, you're seeing that it rolls up to be a little bit less than what the individual managers are. Because there's a little bit of overlap between, but still pretty high active share overall. The next column is the annualized alpha, which, of course, is an excess return measure given the beta. And we're seeing over the 3 years overall alpha being generated in both the public equity as well as the global equity. We see Boston Partners and Manulife as being underperformers in this area. One thing is they are both value managers, and we have seen a really growth-driven market, and we'll touch on that a little bit more later as well.
I think
the next go ahead.
The surprise part is Boston Partners, their up market capture is very low, and their down capture is way high. I mean, that's surprising that for a value manager to have that much down market capture.
Yes, and I think a lot of that, what we're seeing, is this market's being driven by a relatively few number of technology stocks, and those are things that Boston Partners just doesn't hold because they don't meet their value criteria.
When do you evaluate whether you want to keep them or look for somebody else in the slot? Is it? It's 3 years now, but do you, is it a 4 year period, a 5 year period? What are you looking at?
Ken, I want to jump in and just let everyone know. I mean, we've taken a real hard look at Boston Partners, and we're going to talk about them with the Investment Advisory Committee. We can come back to the board. It is all about them being a value manager. When we look at their attribution, there's no particular place that they've made a big mistake or anything like that. They have been employing the same process, which has been very successful over the long period of time. And what I've seen as we've been, kind of surveying the news is that there have been, a lot of folks that have been terminating value managers because they haven't been keeping up with a core benchmark. And, one of the things that your suggestion, Bill, which I think was good, and we don't have it here, but, we've been also evaluating Boston Partners against the value index, and they've struggled there as well, but part of the, but not nearly so much and kind of for the right reasons. So this is one, we can talk about it in more detail and Greg will, but I just want to kind of jump in with my strong conviction on this, this manager.
Okay. I mean, when you come back with after going through the IAC, I think that to show it against value would be helpful, at least to give us some comfort level.
Yeah, I think Greg might have some of that. Sorry, Greg, sorry to jump in. Go ahead.
No, I have a question. I have a question, but that also leads to the asset allocation, even like a lower level. So are we going to say that we want to go more growth than value? Because you don't want to create a situation of salad dressing, right? I mean, if they're doing what they're doing, and to your point, the ones that are the big tech ones are growth or things that they don't do. I mean, do we just want more exposure to growth? Because value has not done well in this market.
Probably the wrong time to be making that change, I would think.
But that's my point. My point is, Bill, that's what you're saying, though, because if you don't want – if Boston Partners is a true value fund, they are going to do bad in what these markets are, but then you're saying, like, should we reevaluate them? So that's my question.
Yeah, my comment was reevaluating them relative to another value manager. I mean, Manulife is a value manager also, but they're doing a lot better. Are they doing poorly even relative to their index is my point.
So we'll start with Boston Partners.
And I think the investment committee can really look at all this, right? And at the end of the day, you should always show it against a comparable benchmark. And it would make a lot of sense to have some type of information ratio and things of that nature. My comment is I don't think we need to get bogged down right here.
All right. Well, that's a good point, though, for your group, though, Gilbert. So your Gilbert should look at those things, right? Correct?
That's exactly what we look at.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. So if we move on to slide 40, I just wanted to give a quick snapshot of what the portfolio looks like and a few takeaways here. Is you can look from a holdings perspective. We really have managers that are doing concentrated portfolios, really kind of concentrated best idea portfolios. From a market cap perspective, overall, we're a little bit on the larger cap side. When you look at the ratios, price to earnings, price to book, price to sales, those really are looking at whether people are growth or value, and you'll see it kind of play out where those ratios are lower for Boston Partners and Manulife and higher for Invesco and Walter Scott. And then the last three lines at the bottom, the large, mid, and small cap exposure, gives you an idea of the different manager styles. We get most of our small cap exposure through Boston Partners and some more through Invesco. And then Walter Scott and Manulife are generally on the larger cap side. So moving to the next slide. So this is the growth versus value dynamic that has been a big topic in the market, and we've been looking at it pretty closely ourselves. This just shows from 2014 to the present, you see that growth has really dramatically outperformed value over the past few years, growth being the blue and value being the purple line. So that's one way to look at it is from total performance perspective. John, if you go to the next slide. I'm sorry, 42. Thank you. So this chart really looks at it from a historical perspective and how big the variation is. So the line that you're seeing in blue is the performance of value versus growth. So you see in earlier years, you've seen some outperformance. In the later years, especially towards the right hand at the end of the chart, it's dramatically underperforming. Those red lines are your two standard deviations. So we see that this divergence in performance, you know, with two standard deviations covering about 95% of events, this really is well outside of historical norms. And when you look over really longer periods of time, value has traditionally outperformed growth, but you know, not in recent markets.
Isn't a part of this, Greg? I mean, isn't part of that two factors? I mean, one is you've got a market cap in the indexes versus most portfolio managers tend to more equal weight their stocks. And then you've got five stocks in the index now that represent 25 to 30% of the marketplace, you know, being the Apples, Amazons, Microsofts, et cetera. I mean, you got a very extreme situation, even more extreme than 2000 when the tech bubble occurred.
Yeah, that's very true. And it's a good point because it is a big factor behind that is this market concentration of the top performers. I think, it was a year-to-date basis in June. The 10 top performers within the NASDAQ were responsible for 90% of the performance. And then when we look on a global basis, without kind of the top 10 performers, the overall performance would have been flat. So you're right. There is a market concentration issue at work.
I think it's important for everybody to know that. Go ahead.
John, if you'll go to the next slide. So now we'll just kind of go through the individual managers to give some highlights. So Boston Partners is a value. Again, they're really a deep value, so you're not going to see a bunch of the high flyers in there. Their process and philosophy is based on looking at the interaction of three, what they look at from a circle perspective, like a Venn diagram of sorts, is they look at the relative valuation, they're looking for strong business fundamentals from the balance sheet, and they're looking at how those fundamentals are generating momentum over time. The other thing to note about Boston Partners, again, it's an all-cap strategy. In their process, they're doing quantitative and fundamental analysis. And those are kind of the big things to think about Boston Partners with regards to it's a deep value, it's an all cap. John, should we go to the next page? And here's where we look at the performance. So you'll note on the lines, you're going to see that it's measured against the MSCI World, which is their stated benchmark, as well as the MSCI World Value. The bottom two lines you can tell is the excess return versus the value, excess return versus the World Index. So you're seeing dramatic differences. They're doing okay versus their benchmark. Now, over the three-year period, there's a little bit of underperformance, but when you look at the performance versus the World Index, that's where you're seeing a big underperformance. But by the same token, when you look at the World versus the World Value, there's a dramatic difference in performance there. And you know, we've kind of highlighted that on some of these other slides. As we talked about earlier, the Boston Partners' detriment on a relative basis, they're not holding Apple, Microsoft, PayPal, and Amazon, and that's been a detriment to their performance. They're fighting kind of this value headwinds, but they're sticking to what they do, and they're sticking to their process. So they're not chasing the benchmark. As far as their current positioning, if you look, they're overweight Europe and they're overweight emerging markets and underweight North America. They have added to some healthcare and pharmaceuticals during the sell-off earlier this year, and they're overweight industrials and materials. Next slide, please.
Greg, this is Kent. I'm just going to ask you to kind of keep an eye on the time and maybe move through these a little bit quicker. I know Nick has to leave a little bit later, so just make sure you hit the important points on these and keep it moving. And if anyone has questions, we're always available to come back and talk about it more.
Yeah. All right. So Manulife is our other value manager. Manulife you can think of more as a relative value manager with a quality focus, and that's kind of the key thing to remember. It's a value and quality. They're definitely a long-term perspective, and one of the distinguishing characteristics is they do take really active ownership after they make an investment. With regards to doing proxy voting, they're engaged on ESG, the social side of things. And they have really good program with regards to ongoing monitoring and following up within the company meetings. Going to the next slide. Manulife, when you look at the performance again, I probably should have showed them against the value index here. I apologize. You would see some outperformance against the value index. Now, they tend to outperform and have kind of a defensive portfolio, so they tend to do better in down markets and kind of preserve capital in down markets. But when we see sharp rallies, that's when they tend to lag, and a lot of that's due to their focus on quality. And we're seeing that play out in the numbers here. We don't have a ton of data for them, but you look in the short term and we are seeing some underperformance there. The other factor there, of course, is sort of the value headwinds. Moving on to the next slide. We list at Invesco. We title it formerly OFI just to remind people. This came from Oppenheimer's. It was OFI, Oppenheimer's Institutional Management Group. Invesco acquired them in 2019, so they still have the same team, the same strategy, the same process. It's just under the Invesco flag. This strategy is really a growth and high growth. It's a high beta, which tends to produce high volatility, but they're outperform over time. A lot of their investment thesis is based on what they see as macro themes that are going to generate long-term returns, and they're always looking at a holding period of 5 years for their investment thesis to play out. Some of those themes are the aging demographics, mass affluence and growing affluence of middle class, but especially in emerging markets, and new technologies. They, again, tend to have more in the large and mid-cap. And then if we go to the next slide, I'm sorry, John, 48, please. Thank you. So from a performance perspective, you can see that OFI has had pretty strong performance. Again, being a high beta manager, when the market's rallying, they're going to tend to rally. When the market's down big, they're going to be down big as well. But over the longer term, they're still generating pretty good excess returns. You'll notice one thing on their holdings is that they do hold some of the technology names. They've got Adobe, they've got PayPal, they've got Alphabet. And stock selection has really been the driver of performance. You can see in Q2 they actually outperformed 8 of the 11 sectors within the ACWI benchmark. Moving on to the next slide, please. So Walter Scott is our other growth manager. And Walter Scott, you can think of as growth with a very high focus on quality. They're preferred companies that have little to no debt on the balance sheet and really looking towards strong fundamentals. Because of that positioning, we see, again, Walter Scott tends to perform well and protect capital on the downside, but then lags a bit whenever the market rallies big. Walter Scott also notably has a pretty concentrated portfolio, and they think from a really, really long-term perspective, very low turnover, 50 holdings in the portfolio, almost half of those they've held for 10 years. The next page. And here's where we see the Walter Scott and the performance. Over the longer term periods, 3 and 5 years, you're seeing sizable outperformance. On the quarter to date, they have lagged. Again, that's what we talked about in the down markets. In the first quarter, they outperformed quite well, but have underperformed when the markets kind of rallied back. The other things to note about Walter Scott is it is stock selection here again that drives their performance. Ironically, they've actually done better in stock selections to the sectors that they're under-allocated to and underperformed in the sectors that they're over-allocated to. Another thing to note about Walter Scott is really they have no exposure to financials. Moving on to the next slide, please. RBC is our current emerging markets equity manager, and you can think of them really as a core emerging markets manager. They are really a GARP, a growth at a reasonable price type of manager. They do have some quality focus. Their philosophy and process, again, focuses on major macro themes that they see as the rise of the consumer, domestic consumption within emerging markets, and then new technologies like robotics. And these are kind of themes that they look at to generate value over the longer term. RBC also has a big focus on ESG, and it's baked into their process. Going to 52, please. So on a performance basis, we see since inception in January of 18, which is on the far right-hand side of the chart, they have generated excess return. In the shorter period, they have underperformed, and then you see on a year-to-date basis, as we mentioned, no real significant additional benefit or detriment to the overall portfolio. So RBC, they're very active and pretty much benchmark agnostic. So they're active in both sectors and countries. Notably, they're underweight to China, which is a big component of the emerging markets index. They've got double the weight to India, and they've had no Russian exposure. So they really are a very active manager, and that's what we want to see in an emerging market manager, where there tends to seem to be more opportunities and it's a little bit less efficient than the developed markets. RBC in general, too, we see some downside protection where they'll outperform in the down markets historically. And here again, because of their macro basis, they're looking from a very long-term perspective. So that really concludes the review. In general, again, I think you'll see we've got a diversified portfolio. We do have conviction in our managers. And in general, the managers, as well as the portfolio as a whole, are performing within our expectations. Are there any other questions?
Yeah, Greg, can you tell, one of the questions I've had all along the last 2 or 3 years is how much of the value that they're adding is by making country selections within a global portfolio mandate versus stock selection? I mean, would we be better off with a more typical conventional one is having a U.S. portfolio managers and then having non-U.S. portfolio managers. Do we see the value we're getting there, or have we looked at that yet? And maybe that's a question for Leo and Kent and everybody else to think about.
It's a good question. We have been looking at the attribution from stock selection versus sector or even country. And what we've seen is, especially over the long term, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, all of our managers, the value add is mainly coming from stock selection. We even, about a year and a half ago, looked at had them separate out their attribution from domestic versus international to try to see, are they doing well domestically? You know, is it the same story? Is the outperformance coming from stock selection, or is it coming from sector allocations? And broadly, we're seeing it is coming from stock selection.
Okay. I having an attribution schedule on this going forward would probably be interesting and helpful.
Okay.
Thanks, Greg. Bill, I think next we've got Makita on deck to talk a little bit about performance. And Leo, maybe as you start off, you could just talk about kind of any observations you had about the presentation, what you've been seeing kind of across the fund and public plan universe, and you know, any thoughts you had about our global equity managers.
Yes, Kent, and good morning, everybody. Can you hear me well?
Yes.
Great. So overall, a good presentation. Certainly, more detail can be provided. I joined just when this section was starting. I don't know if there was a mention or not, but this is going to be a big topic for the next IAC meeting coming up in just a few weeks. So we're busy working internally and collaborating with staff in conducting a lot of different analyses, trying to view this global equity portfolio from multiple lenses to coming up with the optimal way to invest the 30% or so capital we have at stake today, which will be growing in due time. Growth versus value is a very big topic today. It's a big one for us at Makita. We'll continue to review that. I think in the short term, we didn't see any catalyst for this growth versus value dichotomy to reverse with the yield curve as it is, with interest rates where they are, with the large weight still of financials in the value sector and the tech, consumer discretionary in the growth sector. You know, at some point in time, it is going to reverse, but we don't see any catalyst here over the very short term for that. Certainly, we can provide, and we'll be, you know, working with staff to show more information ratios, Sharpe ratios, and attribution by strategy, by the asset class, and that's fine. I'm likely the best starting point is with the IAC again at the end of September. So we understand the questions that were raised today, and we'll seek to deliver those first via the IAC and then consolidate that and, you know, report back to the board.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. So we do have a task in front of us, which is to show performance of the fund. We have two reports. One looks at the, you know, the traditional consulting, if you will, the full view, and then another one that is just the performance of the private markets. We'd like to check in with Bill or Ken, and if you could please have an estimate of the time we should allocate here, please.
If you can give that. We're looking at 20 to 30 minutes, somewhere in that range.
That's fine. So if we can please go to the first page in this section. Great. Thank you very much. One second. I'm going to look it up on my screen. It's going to be a little bit bigger for me. All right, so this is slide 57. So it looks at the performance of the system as of the end of June. So overall, a strong quarter on an absolute basis with gains of about 5.6%. We know that this is a material underperformance to peers and policy, largely due to the underweight, as Greg described, of about 20 percentage points in the global equity and emerging markets equities composite aggregate. This same positioning helped dramatically during the first quarter, so that when you aggregate both, you come up ahead. But in this second quarter, and in what's happening within the third quarter, there's going to be a lag from that perspective. And we understand that given the overweight to private equity and real estate, which tend to move on a more smooth basis. The safety reserve is at the right amount, and you will recall that very recently there was another rebalancing to maintaining that, so very pleased to see that at target. Performance of active managers has been mixed, half of them outperforming during the quarter. That has been fairly consistent, although they're not necessarily the same managers are the ones that that beat the respective benchmarks. Performance of the public markets, which we have been asked in the past to report against peers, has been positive, ranking about in 27th percentile. And with respect to your compliance with targets, emerging market equity, which you will recall is the last item to rebalance, given the rebalance protocol that we had in place in the investment policy statement, is slightly below its target range. So just highlighting that for you.
Kelly, you may want to give Kent our new investment policy statement or our older one that we developed, as well as our rebalancing, so he can see what you know Leo is referring to when he makes comments.
We plan to do a trustee orientation as soon as the mayor appoints his other people. We wanted to do Ken with whoever the new trustee will be, but we plan to do that.
Good. Thank you.
On the next page, similar format, we just look at the trailing 1 year. In this case, again, the absolute performance is positive at 4.7, although a tad behind the assumed rate of return for that year. Performance is very good on a relative basis versus peers and the policy benchmark. And the public markets at the bottom, again, ahead and beating the respective peers. So overall, it's very decent performance, very strong if you look at it on a relative basis, you know, ranks among the top. This is due, again, largely due to the large underweight to public equities and the commensurate overweight to privates, which didn't suffer as big a decline in the first quarter. We can skip the next page and look at the 3 years and just focus more on the shorter term to understand where we are. There was a big rebound in the second quarter that brings the assets on page 60 to just under $2 billion. Subsequently, we crossed that bar, so we are above that as we are speaking to you. The next set of pages look at quarterly performance on an absolute basis and the relative basis, what helped the most, what hurt the most. Again, not a surprise, global equity, most volatile, and the largest section in your portfolio at 30%. So in quarters like this one, that was the biggest gainer on an absolute basis, adding about 80 plus million in assets to the fund. You'll see that 10 of 14 had net gains during the quarter. The contribution of the others was a lot more muted in terms of the asset class, even though some of these hold significant assets as well. Next page, look at it on a relative basis. Page 62, I'll just highlight that when we're talking relative performance, the choice of benchmark matters a lot. For example, if we're talking private equity, you can use a public markets benchmark plus a spread. The choice of that public market index matters. You can use an S&P or Russell 3000 or a global equity. At times, those can diverge. The choice of the spread matters as well. You can also use like a private equity composite, such as like a Cambridge, or there's a few others. And you can also choose to lag or not buy a quarter. So all those choices will make big impacts. And in some cases, when there is a quick reversal, as in the first quarter and second quarter of this year, that can explain a lot of these very large outperformance at times and underperformance at different times. So just, you know, take some caution when you look at these numbers because the choice of those benchmarks do matter. We're going to skip to page 64, please. Here we look at the excess returns versus the relative index for the top three performers and the bottom three performers during the quarter.
So we'll see at the top, Invesco outperforming by about 6%. Same magnitude for Brandywine, recovering after a tough first quarter for them. And then Ashmore, similar story there, as both have quite a bit of emerging market sensitivity. And on the bottom, no surprise there. We already spent some time discussing both Manulife and Boston Partners, but also Pacific Asset Management. It's a very risk-aware, conservative bank loan strategy that performed very well in the first quarter. And when markets rally, they should lag. So I'll say there's no big surprise there. And on the net, they are ahead with a very strong performance since you had them back in 2017. So no major surprises here in terms of who performed well and who didn't in the second quarter. Next, we're going to look for a few slides at your liquidity exposure, and this hasn't changed a whole lot. We'll address what we've seen. You know, we have about 2 years and change working with you. There's been some movement, some improvement in your liquidity exposure. The percentage of illiquid has decreased somewhat, although the legacy aspect of it has not changed too much. That is due to the fact that while we did see some distributions in real estate, there was an appraisal in your private equity book, and so that kind of gets that net figure about the same as it was just a couple of years ago. We'll see that on the next page, on page 66. So this number for legacy assets has fluctuated typically from about 25th through 28% of the total fund. Again, the changes in the numerator, mostly private equity going up and real estate decreasing as a result of distributions. And then the denominator, which, you know, right now it's been increasing the past few months, but in the first quarter it has gone down, and so it made that number look larger. I think I've seen in the section earlier today that in the investment overview, Kent went over the primary objective is to continue to work through this, and this being a key goal for the fund to continue to move through this overexposure to illiquid assets. So with that, we'll spend a few moments on the rest of the portfolio, and then I'm going to turn it over to Aaron to address the private markets. But before I jump into the performance update, I'm making a few comments. This was the executive summary. I'll pause to see if there are any questions. Hearing none, I will continue. So on slide 68, we look at the asset allocation on the left, major categories like equities, fixed income, real assets, and to the right, split into more specific sub-asset classes. As I mentioned earlier, emerging markets equity is a tad below its 3% lower range bound. Global equity has been increasing. It's at 26.3%, has increased a bit more with the good performance the last few months as well. The two outliers, you see those, the blue areas that are above and beyond green are primarily private equity and real estate. As a result, you have commensurate underweights to essentially listed equities. On slide 70, we have a trend line here for your asset allocation, historically looking at quarter ends. And what you see is on blue is your listed equities. So you see slight increases over time. So if you look at, I don't know, 2 or 3 years back, you see some improvement there. Private equity actually has increased a bit as a result of that expanded valuation in one of your strategies. Fixed income has definitely increased over the last 2 years, primarily a result of terminating some of your, I guess, all of your GAA strategies in the second quarter of 2018 and some redeployment of capital received there to maintain that safety reserve on funds and new allocations as in investment-grade bonds. So the one that has really decreased has been your real assets composite in terms of the weight, which used to be over 50%. in 2017, and now it's about 25. Performance, again, we kind of provided some numbers before, but on slide 71, we can see a bar chart, very easy to see the lag in second quarter, the net outperformance during the trailing 1 year. We're not showing here the meaningful outperformance in the first quarter of 2020, but when you aggregate those, you come up way ahead. 3 years looks fairly close, but 5, 10 years and beyond, severely impacted by underperformance largely in your illiquid portfolio over the years. Some attribution, the next few pages, you know, you can look at these charts again, some is the choice of benchmark, but I think the big takeaway is, you know, the amount of capital you have to play with within global equities. When markets rally, you lag. When markets contract, you come out ahead. So that's, again, going to be the primary driver. You can see that on slide 72. And when you look at the year, it's just the opposite. That underweight, the blue line turns to the right. That is the asset allocation effect. And so if you're underweight and the markets went down, then you have a net positive contribution to performance. We can skip a couple of pages to show relative performance versus peers. That would be on pages 78 and 79. And 78, here are the same performance numbers that I mentioned moments ago. But if you look to the bottom, you have parentheses. Those represent the ranking for the fund and the policy index. The dots represent where you fall, you know, graphically versus peers. This captures 5th through 95th percentile, so there's a few outliers when you do really well or really poorly. In the quarter, you rank last 99, but when you look at the year-to-date or the trailing year, you rank at the top. So, again, you have material tracking error due to your positioning versus many of your peers. And we know this is something we're working to. We know it's going to take time. But overall, pleased to see the trailing performance in the short term improving. The next and last page I will cover is page 79. Here we look at just the performance of the assets excluding your illiquid investments. And so here you see less extreme. But you see, generally speaking, in the short term, performing quite well, ranking towards the upper third of your peers, which are public funds with assets between $1 and $5 billion. So with that, I conclude my prepared remarks. Happy to provide also commentary on what we're seeing in the capital markets and in the economies, if that makes sense. I also know you're pressed for time, so I'm going to pause and, you know, I'll seek guidance from you. If not, I'm going to turn it over to Aaron.
Why don't we go to Aaron and then see if we have a little time for you to make those general comments. Okay, Leo?
Works for me. Aaron?
Thanks, Leo. So if you go to slide 91, please. A couple more. I just have my page numbers wrong. The first page in the private markets report, okay, 93. So I'm going to cover just the first four slides here. As a reminder, this is a March 31st report of your private market investments. So these values come from the individual private markets managers. And as you know, they report their valuations on a 90 to 120 day lag typically. So you get your first quarter marks, you get them usually in say June or July. So these values here represent how the managers marked their portfolios March 31st, really in the depths of the kind of COVID crisis in terms of how it was impacting public markets. So this picture graphically looks almost identical to what it looked like one quarter prior. You can see real estate and private equity are still the bulk of the remaining exposure. If you drill into the numbers, I did the comparison to the December 31st values. The only material changes are in infrastructure. It's about $7 million less in market value. In timber, about $6 million less in market value. And in real estate, about $3 million less in market value. So not really material swing relative to what we saw in the public markets as of March 31st, but as Kent and Ryan and the team have been doing, we would estimate that some of these marks are, not fully incorporating the impact of kind of that first quarter and second quarter slowdown in the world and how it impacts these assets. Let's go to the next page, please. Okay, so this chart we like to explain each meeting. The green lines are called distributed per investment, and the blue lines are distributed per investment, and the green lines are total value per investment. So the way to read this is if you're looking at agriculture, and if you invested $100 million in agriculture, the blue line indicates that you've already received back $220 million on the $100 that you invested. The green lines represent what you've received back plus the remaining market value. So you can see in agriculture, you've more than doubled your investment, plus you have about, 1.2 remaining versus what you put in. This graphically looks the same as it has quarter over quarter. You can see, the sore spots have been all the other private market assets where you've, for the majority of them, received less than 50 cents on the dollar so far for every dollar invested. And you can see you're underwater still in real estate and infrastructure, and you're basically slightly at cost in private equity and timber. So over time, you want to see the blue bars go up, and we want to see both go up, but blue bars are money back in your pocket. Green bars represent some element of unrealized value as well.
And Aaron, I know you get the footnote there, but I think it's just important to point out this is only the active investment. So like in infrastructure, when we sold the toll roads for, two times invested, it kind of drops off the chart. So you're only looking at the current investment in the portfolio. And ag is so high because we've had that portfolio since 98.
Correct. Yeah, good point, Ryan. So these are just assets that are on the books today. So once something is fully exited, it's not shown here. It's shown at the end of this report in a tabular completed investment summary. So we've got a slide 95, please. So this is the numerical version of that page prior. And if you want to look at the one most kind of indicative or summary number, it's the bottom right in gray, the IRR. That's a net IRR. So basically that's saying on all these current private market investments over the time you've held them, the return has been about 1%. And as Ryan mentioned, some of the successful investments are fully sold and shown later in the report, but this is what remains. These investments, which represent about $850 million still in the system, and a return of about 1%. The final page I'll talk on is 96. So out of that 800 or so market value, you can see here the bottom right, last line, the total amount that you have unfunded or committed but yet to be called by these managers is $14 million. So I guess the silver lining is that these investments that were made many, many years ago, there's not a lot of money to be added there. And in fact, if you look at the vintage year on this page of all these different investments, you can see many of them are, you know, from mid-2000s. And so these are all well past their investment term. So for some of these, it's very unlikely that they'll truly call that far right column. So my takeaway here is that you have less than 1% of your total system in promised money to these private markets, and I would argue that what you actually need to add to these will be much lower than this in terms of what these managers can call from you.
I don't know, Kent, do you want to add anything about where you think you stand in terms of whittling this all down or anything in the pipeline?
I think, you know, we cover that. Ryan does a good job of covering that quarterly. And so we're not a lot on the near-term horizon. There's expected to get a real estate distribution probably in the $7 million range in the next month or so. That'll be helpful. Other than that, nothing real close. I also would mention, and I forgot earlier, but we had talked a few weeks ago about potential funding that would be needed for the Vista 7, and that ended up, that project didn't materialize, so we won't have to go through with that. We'll continue to think about how to monetize that particular building. And I'll immediately turn it over to Ryan, who's really watched this stuff a lot closer. So, Ryan, any additional comments?
There's a real estate property in Idaho, the land one, that is getting closer to potentially a year-end or Q1 sale. Hit a few milestones there with money going hard, so probably be coming back in the next 1 or 2 months to talk to you guys about that sale. But that'd be a good one. Get off the books. It'll help the blue bar charts when we get rid of that one.
Okay.
Thanks, Ryan.
Leo, we got about 5 minutes. Do you want to give us a general overview of what you guys are thinking about the markets at this point?
Yes, happy to do so. Can you hear me well?
Yes.
Yeah, we got you.
Great. Okay, so in 5 minutes, I'll summarize it as following. The economy has rebounded quite substantially, probably ahead of expectations, but also with the fall. What we are beginning to see now are indication of some level of plateauing. With respect to inflationary pressures, we're not seeing many for now, so that does not seem to be a concern. We expect interest rates to continue to remain quite low due to lots of factors. The one area that we're monitoring close is corporate profits. I think the expectations are quite high. If you look at price earnings ratio on a forward basis, we're talking about 23, 24 times. And that's quite high by historic levels. We already discussed earlier the market's being driven by just a handful of companies, with the tech sector taking an ever larger portion of the S&P 500. In this year 2020, GDP is expected to contract about 6%, but expectations are for a full recovery, so that by middle of 2021, we came up and we're back at the levels that we were
pre-COVID. We'll see what that brings us with respect to the economy level. I mentioned earlier, you know, strong rebound. I think earlier we were hoping for about a 10% unemployment at the end of the year. We're already back at about an 8% level. So we'll see what that brings us. I think one thing it is very important to note, which is the tremendous amount of stimulus by major central banks globally. So today the Fed about $7 trillion, the ECB another $7 trillion in total, Bank of Japan $6 trillion, and the People's Bank of China about $5 trillion. And there's certainly a good amount of correlation between influx there and how that translates into the financial sector. That brings tremendous deficits. So debt levels are up overall. These are some of the largest deficits we've seen since World War II. And for us as an economy, that means we continue to be reliant on foreigners to continue to demand our treasury so we can finance it. And today, 10-year yields for treasuries are about 70 basis points. So at Nikita, we're looking at a few things across clients and a few things specifically for you. Across clients, we mentioned already the growth versus value within equities, but we're also looking at, okay, we're going to be in a low interest rate environment for quite some time. What are some things that investors, pension funds can do to try to benefit or, you know, realign their investments in such a low rate environment? With respect to DPSP in particular, it's a whole review of your public equity structure, but also we're looking closely at your non-U.S. Mandate, which is about a 4% target, which is managed by Brandywine today with the negative rates globally or zero rates essentially in developed markets. It has pushed the manager to take more and more emerging markets exposure. So we are reviewing that in consideration of also of your investments that you have in Ashmore. So those are some of the main activities we're working on nowadays, and in the coming meetings, we'll be happy to report back any findings and any potential actionable items for the fund and the trustees to consider.
Good. Thank you. Thanks. Any questions for Leo or Aaron or the Makita team? I'm not hearing anything. Okay, we're right on schedule now. Kelly, could you do the executive director's report before we go into a closed session?
Yes, there isn't much on it. There are the NCFERS and TechFERS publications for you. And as far as open records requests go, we've had three since the last board meeting. Two were from members. One was from a research institute. And all three are closed, and we provided the information. So I don't have anything else on that. Thank you.
That sounds great. Okay, then, John, we've sort of had policy to give people a chance, public, a chance to ask any questions even at the end before we go to closed session. So what is it, 5-star? If anybody wants to address the board, hit 5-star.
Yes,
is that correct?
That's correct.
Give them a few seconds to...
I'm not seeing any.
Okay, good enough. Then why don't we go into closed session. We'll be in closed session for the remainder of this meeting before just convening the supplemental meeting. So let's now move into closed session and clear the lines.